text that we came up with last night was from Hezekiah 6 and 3. Perfect preparation casts out fear. And I put my overhead from that away. I should have brought it down as a reminder. And that is the that is our text for all facets of public speaking. Perfect preparation casts out fear. Doesn't mean that we'll never be nervous, but it means that we have something about which we can be confident if we're thoroughly prepared. At this point, we're moving on to chairing and interviewing. And if you're looking for last night we covered the whole gambit of preparing a message and preparing notes. For those who weren't here, I will show you, maybe I'll pull it out of this. When we started here, we had lovely ringed folders like you have with all our notes. But because we now have, we've got more people than we got notes, everything had to be pulled out of the blue folders so that we could hand back our blue folders. And this is a bit hard to see the way I have it clipped in here. This is not the only way to make notes. It's not necessarily the best way to make notes. But it is just the way that I make notes, and I bring it along to show you. Simply because sometimes you need a starting point, and you can start at a certain point and then think, oh, this doesn't really suit me, therefore I'll get rid of this part, I'll get rid of that part, or I'll do it some other way. I always keep an account of what the notes are about, the date, and where I've used them, because quite often I'll use a topic more than once. And it's a bit embarrassing to turn up or look at some notes and think, oh, I'd really like to use that again, and not being sure where you've used it. So I always keep that. Down here I always write, if I'm using overheads, which overheads I'm using. So that when you pick up your notes to go to a session, you also know how many overheads you have to pick up, or which overheads you have to pick up. So if you're getting there and going to turn on your overhead and you find you haven't got your notes. The other thing that I like to do, if I'm teaching from a set passage of scripture, I photocopy that set passage and paste it in and write the appropriate notes beside it. So what they're worth, I'll pass them round and just let you have a look at it. And so they're just some ideas.
And the ones in red are what, to emphasise or what?
Sometimes it's making it easier for me to see. Sometimes I put quotes in red. Or sometimes it's just to give relief in all the blue writing, because if you're familiar with your notes, you can drop your eyes straight away and pick up exactly where you are. And by having some red writing and some blue, it's very easy to find the place.
That size is very good. It's sort of being neat, and it's one thing, it looks professional if you've got your notes under control or whatever, and you're not sort of seems to be juggling pages that are big or
Phil's catching out for notes as far as I mean a lecture thing like this where you're using the same notes as everybody else, that's a whole different ball game. But that's an A5 size, and we buy an A5. The only reason I didn't bring my A5 folder is that we were flying and everything, the space was at a premium, and so instead of bringing my folder I pulled those notes out of the folder. But I think it's the easiest way to go. The notes are a good size. They're roughly the same size as your Bible. You can anchor the notes. Now, you've got those there in a ring binder. If the wind blows, if there's a fan on the pulpit, or if somebody gets up during the service and opens the window, your notes can blow over, but they certainly can't blow away. And if you've got that security, if you're up there wondering if someone's going to open a window, or if somebody does open a window, and you're unsettling in case your notes blow away, well, that's unsettle you. So we need to take every precaution to make sure there's nothing going to unsettle us, and that's part of our preparation, the careful assembling of notes. I don't think there was anything else really important that we talked about yesterday that isn't in the notes. They're fairly full. Was there anything, Brendan, that you thought came out of last night which didn't really come out of the notes?
We
Now, cheering. Very few people seem to feel that chairmen need to prepare. I think people regard chairing in the same way as they regard praying or scripture reading. But chair people need to prepare just as much as speakers, and probably won't have to prepare as much material as speakers prepare or spend as much time preparing it. But if a chairperson prepares, please forgive me if I say chairman sometimes, if a chairperson does prepare, it's fairly obvious that he's much more in control of the situation, because the chairperson is really where the buck stops in a meeting. And a chairperson should know exactly what's going on. He should be in full control. And if something does go wrong, if somebody has a heart attack, which has happened, if a vase of flowers blows over or the bulb blows in the overhead projector, it's the chairperson who takes over at that point and just gives the directions or calms the people or does whatever. That's the chairman's job. So let's go right back to the beginning. We're assuming that we've been asked to chair a meeting. What do we do? How do we start off? Somebody has asked you to chair the annual missionary conference at your chapel or the Sunday night service, the family Bible hour, whatever. Where on earth do you start? Now, I'll put all the possibles in here that I can think of, the variables. Maybe you won't have a soloist every time or a musician, but I'll just put those in there for the times when you do have them. The first thing you need to find out is check with the person who does the arranging or the inviting and say to them, have you checked on the speaker? Have you reminded the speaker to be there? Have you checked with the soloist? Now, the person may say yes or no, in which case you say, would you like me to check or are you going to? Because some speakers do forget. And I've been guilty I haven't been guilty of it, but I've been in a situation whereby I have had a date in my diary, nobody has checked with me, and I have phoned I've left it as late as I can for about 2 days before a meeting, and I'll phone and say, are you still expecting me on Tuesday or whatever day it is? And three times now, people say, oh no, so-and-so's coming this week. Whereas if they were doing their job properly, they would have checked up. Well, I guess they couldn't if they weren't expecting me. And there's been great apologies because somebody, whoever's booked me, hasn't told the person who's taken over. It's quite often in Sydney, our bookings are done 12, 15 months in advance. And maybe the lady booking the speakers for this time is no longer doing it, and she fails to pass on the list of who she's booked. And that's happened a number of times. So if you're the person, but it can happen the other way, whereby the speaker has forgotten it. Sometimes you might have a diary that goes so far ahead and you might forget to transfer a meeting for next year into your new diary, and if you don't get a reminder, well, you don't turn up. So it's up to the chairperson to make sure that there's going to be a speaker and there's going to be a soloist, if that's the way you work, or whatever else that you're going to have special in your meeting. Then have a think about your program. Write it down so you know the order in which it comes. And I wish I had thought to bring one of our Bible Hour programs. We have four chairmen at our chapel. We recognise them as being our chairmen, and they take turns, they rotate. We don't have anybody else as chairman. Just as we recognise our speakers, we recognise our chairman and our song leaders. One of our chairmen will invariably come along with a computer printout when it's his turn to chair. All the musos get a copy of the computer printout, and he has one too. The PA man has a computer printout. And there to the minute, he has listed all his songs, his Bible reading, and at what point in time those things come up. Now, there's only one way he can do that, and that's by going through it all at home. It doesn't mean that he's inflexible, he can cope with a change, but he can also see if for some reason they've sung a hymn twice, or if for some reason the scripture reading's gone a little bit longer than he anticipated, if the announcements were a little bit long, he can see on his list that says 10:15 that the clock says 10:20, and so he needs at that point to cut back on a song or cut back on two songs. And so when it's time for the speaker to come up, the speaker starts right on the dot. Then the speaker has no excuse for not finishing on the dot. That takes a little bit of doing, but he is always very, very well prepared. He writes it all down. He knows what he's going to say. Now, if we're inexperienced as a chairperson, we need to give ourselves cues or clues. We don't write out, once again, we don't write down everything we're going to say because that sounds very artificial, but sometimes we just need to give ourselves a little cue about what we'd like to say at that point. The less the chairman says, the better, actually. We need to know who's taking part and in which order. It's no point getting there and sort of thinking, oh, I'll see how it goes, and if the scripture reading's a bit long, I'll whack the soloist on after that. That's not good enough. A chairperson needs to be able to pronounce the names of the people in the program correctly. Ever been embarrassed by a chairperson who introduces somebody and they can't pronounce their name? It's really embarrassing. Find out someone's name. If you can't pronounce it as it's spelled, write it in your notes phonetically and even break it into syllables if it'll help you. Carolyn and Bill Sekulis used to be at Emmaus, and I've heard the funniest pronunciations of their name. And yet, it's really spelt phonetically, S-A-K. So if you just put some diagonals in and break that into syllables, no problem with it. But to look at it will be frightening, unless you are prepared. If it's a missionary you're introducing, and they come from some weird country, and there are some very funny names of countries about now, with all the different names changing and the different countries coming and going in Africa and South America, make sure that you can pronounce the name of a country correctly too. It just makes the whole thing more professional. It really does, and it's so important. So we need to be familiar with the program and get that all done correctly. We need to know who's responsible for the PA or the music. Because if you know where to look, or I guess a PA person's always sitting beside the PA thing, isn't he? But sometimes you get two friends sitting together and you mightn't be sure who's operating the PA. And sometimes it's just a glance. Sometimes if you're using a number of microphones and there's a fault, it's a matter of just holding up three fingers or two fingers depending on the output thing that the microphone's in. We have six, and you'll often see someone hold up the fingers to know which microphone's on being worked with. So whoever's working with your PA or your music, tell them anything they need to know. Now, if we have something special on, like a education Sunday that we had a few weeks ago, we had a lot of the children ran that whole of that service. We didn't have a chairperson, all we did was a child. And the children did all the praying, they did the scripture readings, they did the songs. We had a song leader who took the community singing, that was the only adult involved, and he was a teacher. So it was a full education day, and we had a number of microphones. The children had all been trained to move to the correct microphone. Well, we needed our PA man to come to the rehearsal. It would have been no good for him to have arrived 2 minutes before that service started, because he wouldn't have been able to monitor that PA efficiently, because children have a habit of just tapping a microphone as they walk past sometimes, or flicking, and he had to have those microphones off so that they just came up as each child moved forward. And that's the only way that you'll do things well. If you want anything special from your musos, tell them. Don't catch them out. Tell them anything special they need to know. They're very happy to fit in if they're told. Sometimes they come good on the spur of a moment. If it's necessary, they can fill in. But to really catch them out doesn't do it. If you decide that you're going to have a certain song next and then you change your mind, well, all your musos are sitting there with their books open ready to go on the next song, and then for some reason you go backwards. Now, it's okay to jump forwards because they're anticipating sometimes leaving something out if this time is short. But to go backwards throws them into a real flurry, because sometimes they've dispensed with the earlier books that they're using and they're on the floor closed because they've been used, and it can cause chaos. So we need to brief everybody that's involved in the program. A chairman needs to be early. There's no point in flying in at the last minute and flying down the aisle at the last minute. Everybody ready. It just creates confusion, it creates panic. And usually the panic has been created earlier because the chairperson isn't there. And just think, where is he? Is he going to arrive on time? And maybe there are people who have to ask him questions and he's not there. The chairperson needs to be early enough to meet with and brief those taking part in the program. This is something that we like to do. The musos and the chairperson, the musos always, but quite often the chairperson if he's there, and anybody else who's actively involved in the program, the PA person, we meet out in the back room and we pray together before the service starts. And that's where any last minute briefing is done, so there's never any confusion. that's a one-up thing. If you have visitors in it, like a visiting florist, or if it's a convention or something like that, and people are not familiar with the way you do things, you need to talk to those who are taking part and say, now, we'd like you to sit over here, and when it's your turn, you will use that microphone there. And then people know exactly what's expected of them. Otherwise, they don't know where to sit, and they might sit a little bit back in the congregation. It's hard for them to get out. Then they don't know which microphone to go to. They don't know whether to go to the pulpit. They don't know whether to go and stand near the musical instruments. They don't know what to do. So they need to be told exactly where to sit, where to stand to take part, where they fit into the program. Maybe they decide to go to the loo or something like that, and they whiz out, and it's their turn. Well, they won't go to the loo if they know they're going to be on the program at that point. Sometimes, too, at maybe a missionary convention or something like that, you have people sitting up on the platform so that they can just stand up and go to the microphone when it's time for them to take part. Well, usually those people need to leave the platform when the speaker speaks. Otherwise, it can be distracting to the audience to have a speaker here and a group of people sitting behind him. So usually you'll tell your people, now, when we have the last song before Mr. Smith speaks, we'd like you to leave the platform and sit in the front row. And if you've got all this worked out in here, then you can tell them, and there's no confusion, and everything flows smoothly. So after they're all briefed, we pray. We do this with our ladies' conventions in Sydney too. Be happy to comply with any odd request that the speaker may make. Someone who asks for an overhead and screen, or a lectern for notes, and I think we talked about that. But yesterday I talked about my friend who asked for an overhead projector and they wouldn't give her one because it was going to mess up the arrangement at the front of the chapel. So if you're a chairperson, it's like, when you're a chairperson, it's like being a host or a hostess in your own home, and you are responsible to put all those people that you're working with at ease. You are also responsible for putting the audience at ease and helping them to feel comfortable. So if you're uptight, if you haven't planned correctly, if you haven't briefed people correctly, and you're frightened that things are going to go wrong, or if they do go wrong because of your lack of organisation, really it's your problem. And you can cause people you're working with to be uptight. So that if you're uptight, they'll be uptight. If you're disorganised, they'll still be uptight. But if you're organised and calm, well, that peace and that calmness will flow over to the people that you're working with. And maybe you can see someone there who's come along to give a testimony or come along to sing, and they are uptight. And you can calm them and say, look, it's going to be right. We'll pray. Let's pray together. Let's ask the Lord to quieten our hearts. And it's up to the chairperson to set the tone. So that if someone does ask for something odd like an overhead, please comply. Check that there's a glass of water available for the speaker. Speakers only ever need glasses of water when they're not there. You notice that? You can have a glass of water there every Sunday, and the one Sunday it's forgotten, the speaker will get a frog in his throat. Happens every time. Remember, I've put that note in here, your mood, whether it be relaxed or tense, will be communicated to those you are working with. Your purpose will be to make your guests feel welcome and relaxed. And the final point in that section before the meeting is to be well-groomed and suitably dressed, and we've talked about that before. Anybody who's up front should be dressed in a way which is suitable to the group that's being represented there. So that if it's a camp, you wouldn't wear a suit and a tie. As I say, like a beach camp or something like that. Shorts and long socks, or shorts and whatever you're wearing on your feet now, are quite suitable. Whereas I doubt very much whether shorts would be acceptable on Sunday morning at your chapel. Some of our people do wear shorts and long socks in the summertime. I don't think our chair people or our upfront people are ever dressed. It would depend on where your chapel was and how relaxed you were. But we don't ever draw attention to ourselves, pardon me, by the way we're dressed, by being overdressed or underdressed. Well, the meeting's going to start. We've done all those things that we had to do before the meeting, and it's time to start. We start on time. It's always good to start on time rather than to wait for the people to arrive. We have real problems in Sydney with getting people to meetings on time, real problems, and we have tried everything. Usually in our Bible hour, we have some singing, and then we have a children's talk fairly early in the program. And one of our song leaders got quite upset because he'd really planned his singing program for songs of praise, and he saw the singing as part of our worship to God, which it is. But so many people see singing as a time to let the latecomers get there. And so we decided to have one song and start straight into the children's talk. And the number of people who arrived and the children's talk had started, and they had to creep in. Whereas they just bowl in during the singing, they think singing is just a time when they can want it, and it's just so rude. And it is so wrong. Actually, if I'd been an usher, I would stop people from coming in during the singing. Well, I would wait till the songs had finished before people went in, but I'm never asked to be an usher. Probably that's why. I'm not bad. But I think that is a real thing. People do assume that singing is just a time to let the late people get there. It is part of our worship, part of our praise. And why should people wander in during that time? If the meeting's in a home, forget the singing. Sometimes it's chronic. I went to a meeting a little while ago, a ladies' meeting, and it's a lovely ladies' meeting in a home, and they're doing a real work. They have so many of their neighbours in. And for some unknown reason, they have to have this singing. And the neighbours don't know the songs. And I can still remember sitting there last time singing Majesty. And the lady who played the organ did her best. and the ones who were singing were all embarrassed because the music wasn't that good. The song was a hard song to sing. Everybody was a bit embarrassed about singing anyway. And then the neighbours couldn't sing it at all. And it was really terrible. And I should have had enough backbone to say to the lady organising that meeting afterwards, why on earth do you have the singing? I still feel like I'm going to have to ring her and talk to her about it because it was really bad, really bad news. But they feel, I think, it's part of a meeting. We've got to think about everything we do. Now, if she has a good reason for having that singing, that's fine, I'll accept it. But if she doesn't have a good reason for having that singing needs to go, because it's not being praised to God, it's being an embarrassment to the people who were singing. I didn't praise God singing Majesty. I felt terrible. I was just so embarrassed. And I think the other ladies were too. Be warm and friendly, but say only what is necessary. Underline that if you want to. Say only what is necessary. Some chair people seem to think that they've got to have chairman's opening remarks, chairman's closing remarks, and chairman's remarks about the speaker, and chairman's remarks about everything else. A chairman should be quite unobtrusive. He should be there, but virtually not noticed. He makes the meeting flow, or she makes the meeting flow, but without big noting it. So it's up to the chairperson to be warm and friendly, but say only what is necessary. Here we go again. Don't say you're nervous. That'll be obvious. Or apologise for what you feel are inadequacies. We had planned to have something else today, but we're sorry we couldn't do it. We had wanted to do this, but we're sorry. And so straight away you are saying, this is a second-rate show. You're not meaning to say that, but that's what you're saying. This is really not up to par today. So if you had decided to have whoever your best soloist in the world was there and she couldn't make it, fine, they don't need to know that. And it's not very kind of the person that came along to fill in anyway. It's not really good for his or her feelings. Be alert and aware. The chairperson's responsible to keep the show on the road. If anything unexpected happens, you're it. You've got to take over. The very first time I spoke at a women's convention, the PA broke down. And I was so nervous. I've been sitting in that front seat and I didn't know whether I was going to cry or be sick until the time came to stand up and speak. And I stood up. I had to get up and get up the front. And as soon as I stood up, I felt quite calm. That was the amazing thing about it. Got out to the microphone and had my opening sentence all remembered, so we'd make this big start. And from the voice down the back said, Dawn, your microphone's not on. We had a look at the switch and the switch was on. And there was this great flurry while PA people came running to see what the bug was. The PA had been working before we'd started. The song leader had PA working for her. It was just that I was using a different microphone. So there were a couple of minutes of swapping over. Now, nobody did anything. I stood there like a goose while people changed microphones and 1, 2, 3 testing, 1, 2, 3 testing. Now the chairperson should have come in at that point and said, let's have a song. That's what should have been done. And it was a terrible spot to be in, because we had to make our big start all over again for the second time. It just sounded a bit phony. So that's where the chairman comes in, or the chairperson comes in, to take over in the case of the unexpected. If you're responsible for singing, or maybe you're not a song leader, but maybe in the church you're in or the situation you're in, you announce the hymns. Well, I don't know, sometimes the chairperson has to give out a hymn. Be very clear as to what you want from the audience. We're going to sing the whole song or the whole hymn, or we're going to sing verses 1, 2 and 3, and we will stand, here's another one, we will stand on the organ, or stand on the note from the organ. Have you heard that one? We will stand on a note from the organ, or we will stand on the organ. Not quite sure where to stand, but everybody struggles to their feet. So usually it's, you know, the best thing to do is we'll stand when the organ gives us the note or something like that. We'll stand at the instruction of the organ. But otherwise, if you don't tell the people when to stand, if it's your own chapel, you know, you're familiar with your music and you know when they give you the note to stand. But if it's a convention or something, a camp or something like that, everyone struggles to their feet and they're having a look around to see if it's time to stand up yet. So we need to say, at this point we will stand. It's always good to give clear and definite instructions. We've talked about the next one. Don't have an opening hymn halfway through the program. If you speak as a missionary, we've talked about that one, know where he or she comes from and be able to pronounce it correctly. And after the meeting has concluded, a sincere word of thanks and appreciation to those who helped the program will be of encouragement to them. Now, I don't mean that publicly. There's nothing worse than a speaker finishing with a good finish and the chairman pops up and has something to say. That is terrible. And if you're going to thank the people, thank them. If you've got a soloist and you introduce your soloist, you just want to thank Mrs. Singh for coming today, that's good enough then. Thank them personally afterwards. That's the time to do it. When you do introduce your speaker and say his subject is the love of God. We're going to introduce Mr. Bill Smith today. He's talking about the love of God. I read a book recently about the love of God, and it talked about this and this. Oh, wonderful subject. I really love talking about this topic. And on you go. And, of course, when Bill gets up to speak, he can virtually say, well, we've heard our speaker this morning. I can sit down. Now, to revise what we've talked about chairmen, there are the Ten Commandments for chairpersons, which I stole from Cedric. He used to lecture on public speaking to the men at Emmaus, and I quite like what he had here. And this virtually summarises all the things that we've talked about. Maybe introduce a couple of others. We shall at all times remember that we set the tone of the meeting. That's the chairperson. So that if we're scared, if we're nervous, if we're uptight, that will be communicated. You've lost your pen? How about that? You shall be armed with all the facts that you need. That means prepare well. Know what's going on. Know the order in which it's going to happen. You shall make sure that your remarks are brief. You shall ensure that hymns and tunes go smoothly. Now, if you're responsible for taking the singing and you are a visitor, or having hymns and you are a visitor to a chapel, check with the musos and make sure the people know. Because there's nothing worse than having a hymn that nobody knows. Maybe the words are familiar, maybe at that chapel they have a different tune to the tune you know, or maybe the tune that you want is not well known in that chapel. It's worth checking through. You shall ensure that announcements get across smoothly. Now, you may do those announcements, you might have somebody else who comes and does the announcements. But whichever way it goes, read them to yourself before you read them out. At our chapel, my husband does the announcements, well, he writes the announcements, or he types the announcements. And before he got his computer, he's still a terrible writer, but his handwriting was really bad. And often there was stumbling over the announcements, and I used to think, oh, Graham's handwriting. But now he does them all on the computer. So when he gets there on Sunday mornings, he always gives typed out announcements to both the chairperson and the man that does the announcements after the breaking of bread. And yet people still muff them because they don't read them before they get up. And he is always there in time. No chairperson has ever given the announcements as he walks to the seat, to the front. Graham always gives him his announcements well before the service starts, and yet quite often they don't read them. And then, you know, people are embarrassed, people are confused. You shall prepare the audience for the speaker. And that's certainly not by telling them what the speaker's going to be, or go on about what the speaker's going on about. You shall keep off the speaker's subject matter. You shall not apologise, and I'm going to say not apologise, too profusely for changes of plan. The only time you'd apologise for a change of plan is if the soloist or the speaker or somebody had an accident or a flat tire or something like that on the way, and it was something completely out of control. If it's just your eyes, you just become more efficient next time. You shall see to it that the main purpose of the meeting is not submerged, because sometimes that can well happen. And you shall be flexible. Questions or comments about chairing?
You mentioned that you have four chairpersons in your assembly. You don't give the opportunity then to other people that may have a gifted chairperson.
Not on Sunday mornings, not at that particular service. That is our public service for the week. And we like it presented professionally.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly involve other people in less formal services at other times.
Try them out where there's not so much of a high level public view.
Yes.
Oh, right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise they don't get the opportunity.
Yeah, really muck the whole service up.
We have one our number four man this year. Well, I'll say number four. He's new.
Mm.
We could see potential there. We had three chairmen before. Now we have four because he's a young teacher, and his song leading's good. His presentation's very good. So he's been added to the team this year.
In other words, he does the cheering and the song leading.
Yes, all our chairmen do song leading as well.
Mm.
Yeah, we have a good we have a combination.
Mm. Yeah, most places they have a chairman or chairperson and a song leader.
Mm.
Mm.
Now, my brother's a very good song leader, but I wouldn't see him. He'd be quite a good chairperson too, but he is one of the best song leaders I have seen.
Mm.
And he's rarely asked to chair, but he's always asked to song lead. But if he was at our chapel, which he's not, he would be we'd give him that dual role because he could do both.
It's two person on the platform, doesn't it?
Yes. And I guess the time will come when we may have to consider that somebody who has the ability to chair well but doesn't song lead well, and in which case we'll have to come to some arrangement.
Right.
Would you feel that using two people actually is giving them scope for gifts? Using the gift?
I would think so, but I would see it depends on the individuals and depends on the needs. Yes. Certainly if you have someone who's good at cheering and someone who's good at songwriting and they can make up a team, that's good too. Whereas if you can find one person that does both, that's one less person to fiddle with on the pulpit on Sunday morning. Certainly, you know, we've got to be flexible and use the system that suits us best.
I refuse to do both.
Yes, that's fair enough.
Well, whilst doing both, I refuse on the basis that as a song leader, my goal in leading music and leading congregation worship, I saw, was different from cheering, as in leading the organisation of the meeting. And I decided that, because I'm also being mastered as well, I can't afford to get it wrong, like George Simon, but you know, it's fitting them apart and say Mother Cherry and something at the same time.
Mm.
Gets rid of one pressure at least, and then I can just let's concentrate. And that's just something I prefer.
Mm. Well, you'd be good to work as a team with somebody else. And that would be the obvious way to go with you. And it's good, I think, if people can... If one person doesn't do bad, it's good to have a team that is used to working together, a chairperson and a song leader. Because good song leaders are harder to find than good chairpersons.
Mm. The other thing I wondered was, your chairman would obviously act... Your chairman, song leader, would act in his chairman capacity first, or the song leader gets up there and goes...
Start with singing. Always start with singing.
Mm.
About half a minute before the service starts, 29 and a half past our singing starts.
Just to give the late cast time.
Half a minute.
We still have people. We obviously at the front, and I don't see what it has. Something happened recently, and I wasn't on music, and I sat towards the back. I think the PA had really fouled up, and Graham was sort of crawling under the floor and doing funny things and sticking bits of wire together to get the PA working. Something had really fouled up, and I sat down near the PA system with him, and people were still coming in at 22 for a service that started at 8:30. When you're out front, up the front, you don't notice who's still wandering in. You sort of see the place. You notice the place is pretty empty when you start, and it's pretty full halfway through, but I thought that was incredible.
Singing
around
picked up by that
pass. Yeah. Mm. I don't know what it is. I wonder whether these people are rolling to work late. Is it a flexi? Do you think it's our flexi times? Because I think with the jobs now, you haven't got to be at work at 9, in some jobs anyway. You can be at work at 9:10. If you get in there at 9:10, would you leave 10 minutes later in the afternoon? I don't know.
Nationwide with Brisbane, it's 15 minutes
in Tasmania. It really worries me, and I don't know.
It's a thinking to life, I think.
Yeah.
Some people tend to organise their life, and they always tend to be working towards the next thing, and they always seem to be at things on time. Others people seem to always be, you know, maybe chasing their tails or, you know, carry over from the previous thing they were doing or whatever.
I sometimes wonder if people know the service starts at 9:30, if they leave home at 9:30. I think that might be some of their thinking. And depending on how far they travel, that's how late they are. I honestly don't know. It just worries me. But what can you do about it? We've tried everything. With Our Lady's Bible study, we did all sorts of things to try and encourage people to be on time. We even started the lecture on time. You can't just start discussion groups when nobody's there. We used to start with discussion, thinking, well, they're going to have their say, therefore they'll get there on time. Well, that didn't work because no one was there to discuss with, except our group leaders. And what's the point of three group leaders sitting having a discussion? So I thought, well, we'll start the lecture on time, and maybe they won't be rude enough to come in. But you'd start lecturing to your group leaders, and the rest in dribble in.
It sometimes is a function of the importance you place on it too, because you know, if you had a job interview in town or whatever or something, you have to be there. You just certainly don't want to create a bad impression by being late, so you make sure you're there on time. So in some ways, it's a function, I think, of the importance we sort of place on the event that we're going to.
I think it might be right too.
We get
that. That makes it even sadder, doesn't it?
It does, especially.
I think people see I think we've got in our mind that Sunday's our day off.
Yeah.
And therefore we slacken off on Sunday. I don't know. Now another part, or another area that comes with chairing is interviewing. I don't know how much you use interviewing in your church or in the circles in which you move, but it is a marvellous medium for gaining and for extracting information from people and passing it to a group. How's that window? Is that too cold for you? Or
no,
well, I'm happy, but you're the people who've got to sit there under it, so whatever you like. I'm comfortable, thanks. So interviews are sometimes used, pardon me, to acquaint the audience with a speaker, and may involve the passing on of information regarding his or her Christian experience, lifestyle, family or work that he or she is doing. So what that virtually says, you have a Sunday morning Bible hour or a Sunday night gospel service, and you know there's a missionary in town or someone from CYTA is in town or someone from some other organisation's in town, and you think it would be a good idea to let your congregation meet this person or know a little bit about the work this person's doing. Maybe someone from your church has been away on a camp, maybe they've been away at a weekend like this. And I think this is marvellous, because as a church we are a body, we've been hearing all about that, and there are people here this weekend who've had a great time, and they're going to go back to their churches, and life's going to go on and people are never going to know about it. Whereas if one of the elders or your chairperson next Sunday would say, now last weekend, five of our young couples or five of our young people were down at El Shaddai. We're going to ask one of them to come up and we're going to find out what went on down there. And the chairperson would get you out the front and say now. And he'd have his questions structured and interview you. Now that means he can keep you to time. He can find out what's relevant for the people to know, so that you don't just get out there and waffle. And it's a really, really good medium, because often if you ask someone to come out and say, tell us about the camp you went to last weekend, oh, well, there were about 86, and they'll think, you know, scratch around trying, and they'll often come in on trivia, and talk about trivia, and the meals were great. One meal we had such and such, and then there was somebody there from Western Australia, and often the trivia gets talked about, and the important things get left out. Now, if you're the chairperson arranging that interview, you'll know what you want the audience to know. And so you structure your questions. You work out what I want them to know from this person, and you arrange your questions so that you will extract that information from the person, and that person will pass it on to the audience. They're a really, really good medium to use. So you need to know, if you're going to interview somebody, the first thing you know is, what's the aim of the interview? What do I want the audience to find out? What's the purpose of bringing this woman or this guy out the front and getting him to sprout to the audience? So you've got to know your aim. And the next thing you do, you've got to find out a bit about that person. Now, if you are interviewing someone who's been at this camp this weekend and you haven't got a clue of what went on here this weekend, well, your questions aren't going to be very relevant, because you don't know enough about it to be able to extract the right sort of information. So either one of your elders who's been here, or the person who's going to interview you, needs to have talked to you at length, because they need to know as much about the subject as you do, and then they can structure the questions carefully. Otherwise they won't ask relevant questions. They'll ask bland questions or general questions, and they won't come to the nitty gritty of what this was all about. Have I confused you on that, or you're right? So once you've decided on the aim of the interview, then you come to the most important part, and that's to prepare it. So you've got to know as much, or nearly as much, about the subject as the person being interviewed. Otherwise you ask silly questions. If you're interviewing a missionary from Mexico and you haven't got a clue about the work that missionary is doing, unless you talk to that missionary first and find out about the work, you'll just get her up and say, what's the population of Mexico, and what do you do each day? And you don't know what you're aiming at. And so the interview loses its punch. So the big thing is, what questions do I ask? Now, 10 well-chosen questions would easily cover a 5-minute interview, and 5 minutes is long enough for an interview. You can get quite a lot of information out of a person in 5 minutes. 3 minutes actually is quite adequate for an interview. The questions need to be very specific. The first two or three questions establish the area of the discussion. So you would introduce the person, and you would say, we have with us today Mary Smith, who is a missionary from Borneo. I don't think so. It's one of those countries that's changed its name. We no longer know what it is. But that's what you do. You introduce your subject, and then you turn to Mary. And it's really technical. I'm sorry we haven't got time here to practice this, because this is one of the things we practice, the actual interviewing technique, because you have to address the person beside you and include the audience. There's no point in you carrying your interview out to Mary Smith and excluding the audience, so that you have to sort of turn sideways and you use your body to move or rotate from Mary Smith to the audience, or maybe not your body, but your head, the head and your eyes at least, so that you're including her and the audience. And as you're listening to her, you listen to her and you sort of keep an eye on the audience too. You're gauging how they're coping with it. And you just hope that Mary Smith's also talking to the audience. And if Mary Smith's not talking to the audience, sometimes you could phrase your question Mary the Fagat, he would like to know and try and direct her to talk to the people rather than you. And maybe it might even mean moving back a little bit or moving round this way a little bit so that you're getting her voice directed out to the audience. But you need to make your questions specific, and that's why you need to know what she's on about, so that you'll be anticipating the question she's going to answer, or you'll be anticipating her answer. You make your questions very specific. You don't give her an opportunity to be vague, because that's what the interview is trying to stop in the first place. The first two or three questions establish the area of discussion. The fourth and fifth are the really pertinent questions. What are you really doing in Borneo? If she's a nurse, what are you doing in, say, if she's a nurse, what are you doing in your part of the hospital in Borneo? Or maybe it is there a spiritual aspect to your work in Borneo? So you gradually start with the general questions, and you might be, if it's a women's group, you might ask her about the clothes she wears, or the women she works with, some sort of general interest, and gradually hone in till you really come in. Your fourth and fifth questions are the ones you really want the audience to know about, the important things. Because really the main purpose of giving her a promotion is that people can pray for her. And so you come into the points that you want people to pray about. Her spiritual work is what it's really all about. And then if she hasn't been quite clear, or if you feel she hasn't given enough information, you always have a couple of questions up your sleeve which will extract that extra information. Then all you do is finish off, once you've got all the information you need from her, Mary Jones from Borneo, thank you so much. That's all you need. Just finish the interview. So once you've decided on your questions, write them down. Once again, you don't remember, you don't trust your head, write them down. The funniest thing that happens at Emmaus is when we practice these interviews. We do this lecture, and then we say, well, next week I hand out slips of paper to the students and say, now you're going to be a missionary from Bolivia and you're going to be the interviewer, and they have to pair off and do their interviews. And I don't say anything else to them, we just wait for them to turn up. And without saying anything to them, we'll just say, okay, your first two out you go. And they will invariably go out, and they will invariably come with clipboards, and they will always go and sit in front of the microphone. Why is that? Yeah, that's how they see an interview. A television interview. And we might have gone right through this lecture and talked about its use in the local church. But because we've used the word interview, they see themselves on television. And you can let the whole group run, and they will all go out there, and they will all sit on the chairs, and the men will cross their legs like you see the television interviewers doing, and they will tap their biros on their clipboard. It is really funny. And at the end you say, how often would you do an interview like that in your church? What do you mean? Sitting down like that? Oh no, we wouldn't do that in church. Why did you do it here? So that's a real conundrum, and it happens every year. Unless the second year students clue them. So it's funny. Bird interview, television. Quite funny. But we do have some funny interviews. We have some really good interviews. All our questions have to be phrased so that it's impossible to answer with a yes or no. Mary Jones, do you have any children? Yes. Do you have a car in Bolivia? Yes. Do you work at a hospital? Yes. It's a very boring interview, isn't it? So the way to get around that is never start your questions with a verb, with a pronoun. If you don't know a verb and pronoun, you haven't been taught grammar at school, which most of you haven't. So we've listed there for the people who haven't had grammar at school, start your questions with what, and they can't answer yes to that. What do you do at the hospital each day? They can't say yes. I mean, they can, but it won't make sense. Why? Why do you do such and such? Why do you wear those clothes? Or why do you do things in such and such way? They've got to come up with a one sentence or a two sentence answer. Where or how? So if your questions are started with those words, you can never get a yes and no answer. Now if you slip up, if you get nervous or you forget, and you suddenly find that you've asked a question to which she's going to say yes or no, very quickly rephrase it. So that she can say her yes or no, or he can say his yes and no, and then he has to expand on it. Now, if you're interviewing someone who's inexperienced, that inexperienced person might be scared stiff of answering off the cuff because he mightn't know what to expect from you. We did this with a lady from Fiji, from New Guinea. We interviewed her at a lady's house party because she wasn't confident enough to speak. But she wanted her questions beforehand so that she knew what she was going to say, and that was quite good. She didn't come along with them written down, but she had a set of questions beforehand, so she had was mentally prepared for what she was going to meet up the front because she was in front of a lot of people, and she was very calm and very comfortable. So if the person asks you if they can have the questions beforehand, certainly listen to them. But ask them, if they feel so scared that they need to have answers written down, ask them to write in a palm card, because an interview is usually done in front of a microphone like this, not necessarily up on a pulpit. And she doesn't want to get up there with a foolscap sheet with all her answers on it, because that looks really phony. So if the person feels they need to write down, maybe it's figures you're asking, you might ask them for the population, for some reason, men might to know the size of towns or the population. If they need to have figures and they can't remember them, get them to write them on a little palm card. And it's good for you as an interviewer. If you're on a freestanding microphone without a pulpit, a palm card is probably all you need, rather than getting up. You don't need a clipboard just because you're interviewing. Any time you're in front of a freestanding microphone for a testimony or for a short talk or when you're not preaching a sermon, instead of having big notes like an A5, a little palm card, a little cardboard palm card is quite sufficient. And you can have the points just jotted down in there. And you mightn't even need it when you do need it. If you do need it, you've got it there. And it looks professional. Learn how to stop. That's one of our biggest problems. We just grind to a halt. Avoid, we'll have to end there, or we've run out of time. By saying we've run out of time, sounds as though you're unprepared. So, oh, the clock's caught up with us. And that's saying, oh, well, I really didn't expect the clock to catch up with us so soon. Just phrase your last question finally, so that people will know, or so that the speaker will know that you're finishing. Finally, that's the last question coming up. And then just re-identify your subject. Mary Jones, thank you very much. John Harper Nelson, who was one of the best interviewers ever with the ABC, says this: the perfect interview is one in which a series of pertinent questions is put to draw out the character of a subject and extract informative answers in such a way that, at the end, the audience will have received the information without being conscious of the interviewer's presence. A good interviewer will be able to draw out that information without people even realising the interviewer is there. And it's a little bit like that with a chairperson. A good chairperson will have a program flowing without people realising the chairperson is there. Just one more thing about chairpersons. There is no need, if you have a program with songs and a children's talk and a Bible reading and some announcements, a chairperson doesn't have to announce that every time. We're going to have a hymn now and sit down, or we're going to have a Bible reading now. If you've got your people cued, they can just all flow. And it saves all these people bobbing up in front of a microphone, which is very jerky in a service. A service just needs to flow. So the chairperson only needs to come to the microphone when the program can't flow without that person. And that's a good standard to measure by. Betty, have you got your reading prepared?
I did.
You did?
I had a look at
that. That's all right. Would you like to have a little go at it now, just for a change of pace? And we're going to ask the congregation to stand while you read the Word of God to us. Because that really is something. We talked about that last night. Good. Our reading comes from Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verses 1 to 3. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God.
Go near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools who do not know that they do wrong. Do not be quick with your mouth. Do not be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God is in heaven, and you are on earth. So let your words be few.
That's the last chapter of Corinthians 2, and we'll read the last three verses. Finally, brethren, farewell. Be perfect. Be of good comfort. Be of one mind. Live in peace. And the God of love and peace shall be with you. Greet one another with a holy kiss. All the saints salute you. The grace of the Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the communication of the Holy Spirit be with you all. Amen.
Good. The congregation may be seated.
Next question of the overhead projector. Oh, after all that, I've got to show some of our interviewing. There are two things that some of our interviewing. There are two things to keep in mind. What do I want the audience to know? And how can I achieve this? And if we keep those two points in mind when we're organising an interview, we'll have the right sort of questions. How many of you have used an overhead projector? You have, Ken?
Briefly.
This is going to be your big chance. We're all going to have a go at using the overhead projector. Haven't got to say anything. You've just got to use it. Because they're scary things. You see other people use them, they look so simple, and until you go to use it, you get out there and you suddenly find you don't know which way to put the slide on, and you don't know what button to press, and you don't know how to alter the focus. So this is where we learn. We don't do a lot with visual aids, do we, in our churches? The overhead projector is probably one that's most commonly used. Before the OHP, we didn't really bother much. Some people had charts. I'm always talking about what I can remember. I remember going to a ladies' meeting once. I'm a great believer in visual aids, probably because I've done a lot of children's work. And I believe very much in using visual aids with any age group. I went to a ladies' meeting in a home one night, and I arrived there with my easel and my blackboard and my chart rolled up under my arm. And the hostess looked at me with horror and said, "What's that?" And I said, "It's my easel and my blackboard for my visual aid." And she said, "Do you realise you're speaking to women?" And I said, "Yes, I realise I'm speaking to women." And I knew she wasn't very happy, but I thought, well, that's her problem, that's not mine. And we went into the lounge room and we sat up. We talked about heaven that night, what's it going to be like when we get to heaven. The visual aids weren't spectacular, it was just some butcher's paper pinned onto the blackboard. Went back 12 months later, which we have a habit of doing in Sydney, you sort of go around the various traps once a year, you can invite it back once a year. And the chairperson introduced me and she said to the ladies, "Do you remember Dawn coming last year? Can anyone remember what she spoke about?" And there were probably 75% of that good remembrance. Not because I'm a spectacular preacher, but because I took along a visual aid. And there was nothing spectacular about the visual aid. It was just a piece of butcher's paper with some headings on it, some questions. And they remembered it. And I thought, well, that to me proves that the visual aid thing is really in. And have a look at the way we learn. 1% of our learning is done through tasting, 1.5% through touching, 3.5% through smelling, 11% through hearing, and 83% of our learning is done by or through sight. It's a big percentage, isn't it? And yet we fail to capitalise on that in our teaching programs because we're too lazy. Learners remember 10% of what they read, I think this is if you're lucky, 20% of what they hear, 30% of what they see, so there you go, the seeing things up to 30%, 50% of what they see and hear, 80% of what they say, 90% of what they say and do. So that's why you will remember from this seminar the things that you have been pulled out the front to do. You'll remember those a lot more effectively than you will the things you've just sat and listened to. So a good instructor uses a variety of aids. Now, once again, as with anything, we don't use an aid simply because it's fashionable, and I think this has happened with the overhead projector. When they first came in, you had to use an overhead, so people would use overheads simply for the sake of using overheads and trying to impress. We don't do things for those reasons. We've really got to look at our motives for anything we do. We use an aid only when it will help the learning process to be effective. And we use a visual aid when it is the clearest way of getting a message across. So therefore it's quite stupid to reproduce your notes onto an overhead. If you rewrite exactly what's in your notes and put them on an overhead, you're not achieving anything. So if you want to use your overhead, what you need to do is pull your headings out or pull the main thoughts out and put them onto an overhead. Or maybe something you want to emphasise. But just for reproducing your notes and putting them on a screen, it's not going to do anything. And it's rather interesting because quite often when you use an overhead, you'll find that people will invariably copy it down, and it doesn't seem to matter what you put on it. One of the interesting things that I did in small groups, and it wasn't done to prove this, in small groups the other day I did a session on the small groups that are literally running in our church, and I had just put down an aim and the numbers and a meeting place and some specific things about each of those groups, and I put them on overhead more as a reminder to myself of what was going on and just for people who maybe wanted to copy down material we were using and methods we were using. And the number of people that copied those overheads down, and they had a lot of information on them, and I didn't want them up there long enough for people to copy them, but people came and asked for them afterwards so they could copy them down. So in our mentality we seem to think if it goes up on overhead we've got to put it on paper. Don't know what that is, but we do it. Visual aids don't have to be elaborate or expensive. The best are clear and simple. Now, they're vital to teaching because they appeal to the senses. We're using our eyes while we're listening. They're able to attract and hold attention. Now, you know that especially with children. If you're out the front and someone's got something to hold up and show, you're curious enough to watch it and the kids are curious enough to watch it. And they focus attention on essential elements to be learned at the proper time. Therefore, they help the learning process. Now, here's the definition of a good visual aid. It presents one idea at a time. Sometimes you get aids, and especially with overheads, where people put too much information on them. Depends on what you're doing. It depends on whether you're teaching or whether you're also presenting an idea. You've got to qualify that sometimes. So the best visual aid will present one idea at a time in a concise and logical sequence. Colour emphasises a certain point. Now, whether you use overhead, whether you use charts or posters, whatever you use, pardon me, always be careful with yellow. I've seen some beautiful visual aids done by young people at camps, memory verses, charts, and they'll put a lot of yellow on them. You put yellow out the front of the group and it disappears. People can't see it, especially on overheads. As I said, I couldn't bring all the things I wanted to bring this time. Usually I bring some of my really bad overheads that I used to do, and I've learnt. And I bring those to show the students some of the terrible things you can do with them. Now, I have chosen to use yellow there because I wanted just that to present an idea behind the writing. But if that whole overhead was written in yellow, would be hopeless, wouldn't it? Or if anything important there was written in yellow, it would just disappear. So always be careful with yellow on any sort of visual aid. It's good for colouring or shading or putting a suggestion of something in, but it's no good for the bold message that you want to convey. Certainly use colour, but be careful with yellow. A good visual aid, jumping down to number 5, must be visible to all. There's no point in having a visual aid if people can't see it. And it needs to stimulate thinking and doing by the learner. You just don't want it up there because it's a pretty picture or because it's nice printing. It's got to be used. Now, because the overhead projector is so much in use nowadays, we're going to have a real look about the best and the proper way to use an overhead projector, because people use it and they don't know how. We've gone right back to the basics. And it's nothing worse than being at a meeting or somewhere where people go to turn on their overhead projector, just like this, they move forward, turn it on, and it's not plugged in. And that's part of your preparation as a speaker, to make sure that before you get up front, you've got your overhead plugged in. In the notes here it says, check replacement globe is available. I haven't checked this projector to see, I have to be honest. I don't know where this one's come from. But any that you're using all the time, you need to make sure there's a replacement globe available, because if the globe blows, you need to replace one straight away. Most people, most churches, I assume we do, anyway, we have a little tray in the front of ours, it's a different type of projector, and there's a spare globe sitting in. We have a new one. I'll put it on it while it's hot. And some of the new projectors have a little pivot inside, so the new globe sits in here. This is the globe that's currently being used, and it's sitting in the place where it's working. And so all you have to do when your globe blows is pull a little lever, and that swings the new globe into place. But then you need to tell whoever is responsible for your equipment that you've blown a globe, and they will replace the new globe. So there should always be a spare globe, because invariably the globe blows at the wrong time. So it's good to make sure the replacement globe's available, and it's good to know if you know how to fit your globe, because sometimes it can blow, and if you don't know how to fix it or how to replace it, if it's not one of those little pivot ones, well, you're really up the creek there. With the overhead projector, you can project onto a screen or a wall. Screen, certainly the better. And you need, before your group gets in there, maybe you're working in a camp or an area like this, you need to work out before the folk get in that they're going to be able to see. And we had to fiddle in here with this little room to make sure that you were able to see what was going to be projected. Certainly this isn't the best way to use an overhead projector, but it's certainly the best for our situation here this week. And we need to focus the projector before the group gets there. So you need to put it on and put your overhead on, your transparency on. Usually on the overhead there's a wheel or a knob, and that heightens or lowers that, which will affect your that's crooked. Yeah, they must be crooked, or a tail, maybe the tail's crooked, that's awful. Maybe I shouldn't move that too much because it's pretty when it's bigger. Anyway, there's usually one of those knobs so that you can focus your machine. And you need to focus it before it's time to start, because if it's badly out of focus, and if it's a machine with which you're not familiar, it might take a couple of minutes for you to get the hang of focusing it. Sometimes you have to move it forward, depending on the size of your screen, forward or back. The closer the overhead goes to the screen, the smaller the image becomes. Sometimes these things get moved too, the lenses get moved. Don't ever put your fingers on the lenses. People don't seem to remember that, and they want to put their fingers on these lenses. Don't ever do that. And keep the fingers off. We need to keep our fingers off overhead projectors as much as possible. The glass platform there doesn't like fingers on it either. Neither do the transparencies. Well, let's have a look at our operation. Oh, preempted that one. Don't stick your fingers all over it. That's the first one. Don't attempt to move your projector while it's operating. Now, this also goes for 35mm projectors, because their globes are sensitive to movement, and you don't move them while they're hot. That's why most of these things have fans in them, so that the I don't know whether it's to do with contraction and expansion, I have no idea about that, but most of these things have fans, and as long as your fan's running, your machine is too hot to move. Once your automatic fan has cut out and stopped for good, sometimes they cut in and out, once your automatic fan has stopped, your machine's cool enough to move. But don't ever move it while it's hot and while that fan's running, because you damage or you shorten the life of the lenses or the light sources. Not the lenses, the light sources. So don't ever move it while it's hot. And that happens a lot. Sometimes someone's been using the overhead for singing, the speaker gets up and someone comes and grabs the overhead and whisks it out the way, and you sort of think, well, that globe in there will last not as long as it should be. Once again, don't switch off your power source whilst the fan's still operating. Now, the whole idea of moving or operating this, if you put that on as a blank, it's very bright. And this is an old projector on a yellow wall. We're not seeing things at their maximum here. But if you're running a new projector on a nice clear screen, that is bright light. And that's what you don't want to dazzle people, and especially people whose eyesight's not as good as others. So you don't ever run a blank screen like that, not ever. You put your transparency on. Now, if you don't want people to see what's on your transparency, if you want to get it all focused and ready, you do that. Now, if you have worked out the distance from your screen and worked out your focusing, you can know for sure that everything's okay when you put your transparency on, and you haven't got to be constantly checking. If you've got that all squared up, you need to do it when you try it. You need to check and make sure it's right, because this one's so crooked. You can't do much about this, but you square that all up before you start. Then you know if you put your transparencies on there, everything's okay. So you haven't got to be constantly checking, because that shows that you're unsure of yourself when you keep on looking up. Some people, the first time I ever used overhead transparencies to speak, I spoke to the wall. Didn't know where to look. You speak to that and to your people. That's the whole idea of using the thing. Otherwise, you might as well use a chart. So you, instead of looking at the image projected on the wall, you look at your platform, your glass platform with your slide. So you put your slide on, and if you, that's when you reveal it. And once you move it, you turn your light off. Otherwise, if you're pulling that on and off your glass platform, you're dazzling people. And it reduces the impact of your new slide coming on. If people have got to cope with that bright light, once the new slide comes on, the impact is not the same. That's the psychological one. I don't ask me about that, but that's what the experts say. I can't explain why, but that's what they say. So turn it off, put your slide on. If you want to unmask, turn it on. Once it's time for it to come off, turn it off. Now, don't leave it on for extended periods. Now, you'll find that speakers often do this. They put their projector on and they forget about it and they go on talking, and the slide's still up there and they're talking about things that are completely different. They've moved right on from the thing that's on the wall, and by this time people are not listening to them. They're still looking at the slide, and they've had long enough to look at it, and they're looking at the lettering and wondering why they spelt that word that way. So once it's outlived its usefulness, turn the thing off. If you're at a conference and people are likely to be copying them down, keep your eye on the people and you'll usually see the heads come up and you'll think that's been on long enough and get rid of it. But if you, whether the people are finished or not, if you no longer want that there, turn it off. And it directs their attention from that back to you. And that's the beauty of the overhead, because you can pull people's attention straight back to you instead of from that wall. As long as you leave that there, you've lost their attention and you've got half their attention. They're listening to you with one ear and writing down with one eye, and there's divided attention. The only way to regain total attention is to press the button and it gets them back. And what you say to them, sometimes with a big audience, if you've got a couple of hundred people, they can't all write at the same rate, and so you will say to them, I'm going to push this switch for those of you who haven't finished, see me afterwards. And they can get your overheads afterwards and finish copying. And that's the way I work. Works quite well. People will come and get them from you afterwards.
What about the song? Turn the overhead off.
Same principle. You always turn it off, put new transparency on, turn it on. Now, if you're going to mask, I've brought a selection of things. Maybe I just should show you the ideas here. That one there is traced. Now, this blank spot, I often use that with words. I just put words on there. I often use that on the talk of fruits of the fruit of the spirit. that's drawn with overhead projector pens, but the colour there, the colour, you can't, it's transparent, it's very hard to colour in with pens because they leave lines like you're colouring with textures. So that is adhesive sheeting you buy from some of the big stationers, and you draw the outline on the coloured adhesive, peel it off, or cut it out, peel it off and just stick it on, and you get straight colour. You can have a, I don't mind you feeling it smell over here. That's a different system to add a little bit of interest, just the idea of the family, the responsibility of family, the yellow background in behind there that was drawn on. Now you can see that's a thicker pen. You can get overhead pens in different thicknesses depending on what you want to do. And that's probably the thickest overhead pen you can buy. Yes, the ladies like that one. Now here's one that has a problem because I have masks in cardboard. So what I will do is open the first mask, and this is just one I grabbed before I came away. We always, if we're going to mask, we should always mask with something that is opaque that lets the light through. That's why these backings that come with them are good. If I completely covered that with that cardboard on there, there's a few cracks so I can get away with it. But I shudder when you see someone mask out completely with something solid, because the heat is all under the glass and you'll crack the glass. So any masking needs to be done preferably with something opaque, or else you leave a space for the light to get through so the glass won't be broken. And I think this might have been some camp studies on Nehemiah. Yes, or Malachi. And that was just a series. So you can unmask a little bit at a time each point. Now you'll notice there that some of that printing wasn't as clear as it should have been. A bit hard to read, notice that? See that one, that pen there was a bit scratchy. Now there's no point in having overheads that people can't read. So we need to keep our eyes on things like that. Sometimes you scribble them on a pen because you're in a hurry and you think I'll be okay, and then you'll find they're not as good as they should have been. Another way of using overheads. That's copied on a photocopier. If you're going to photocopy overheads, you must have heat or thermostatic material. There are two kinds of overhead transparencies you can buy, the ones you can write on and the ones that you photocopy onto. If you try and photocopy onto the cheaper variety or the non-heat one, it will glug up the photocopying machine because it can't take the heat. Here's another one. One of Montrevity for me. Done on the Apple Macintosh. And then photographed or photocopied. Quite effective. Trevor does some very good, Trevor Young does very good work with his overhead transparency. So that's just a collection or a selection of different kinds of overhead, or different ways you can make overhead transparencies. Now there's a section there on replacement of gloves. We won't really go through that. That's not terribly, it's important, but it's not important for us to, when you can read, if you can read about that. One thing is this, you don't ever put your bare fingers on an overhead globe. Not ever. There is something in your fingers that damages the globe. So what you do is you take out your handkerchief or a piece of cloth and you remove the globe with your handkerchief. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's a dead globe, I guess, but for fitting the new globe. You must never touch a new globe. It won't hurt you, it just shortens the life of the globe, because of something to do with oxidisation. But if somebody doesn't know that, and somebody picks up and says, oh, what's this? And you say, oh, you're not supposed to touch that, get some methylated spirits and clean the finger marks off it. Don't leave the finger marks on there. Just a qualification on D under 3D replacements. Light sources there. That's another way of saying globes. Just in case you're wondering what a light source is. I think the person was tired of writing the word globes and they tried to be original. Light source for globes are very expensive. We talked about the more or less automatic replacement. The overhead projector has advantages, lots of advantages. And they're all written there. I don't really think we need to go through those either. And they're quite, it's just a matter of me reading the notes. Is there any question? Run your eyes down that and see if there's any question on that. That's really written for school teachers. It talks about the advantages of that over using a blackboard. Now, we've talked about the way to use the machine. Number five there is, I think the typist must have been in a bad way by the time she got to this point. She's got making the most effective use of the overall projector. That should be overhead projector. I tell you, these girls worked hard to get these notes out for us. Turn the projector off when positioning a new transparency, when changing transparencies, when the subject discussed is irrelevant to the image being projected, when you wish the class to give you its undivided attention, and when there's no transparency on the projector. We've said all that, haven't we? Another thing is about using a pointer. Can I borrow my borrow for 1 minute, please? If you want to draw attention to a heading or to something on your overhead, that's how you do it, on the projector stage, not on the wall. Because once you turn away from the audience, you've got your mouth away from them, the microphone, your eyes are away from them. If it's a school class, well, you're really asking for trouble because you're looking at the wall instead of the kids. So you always talk. The beauty of the overhead projector is you always maintain contact with the group in front of you. Thank you. So if you point to the projector stage, not to the wall. There are two kinds of overhead projector pens too, just as there are two kinds of transparency sheets. A permanent and a non-permanent. A non-permanent washes off with water, so you can use a projector slide, write with a non-permanent pen. When you're finished, you stick your overhead slide under the tap and dry it with a tea towel, and you reuse it. The disadvantages of that are that if you put your thumb, and you have a perspiry thumb, on part of your thumb, when you take your thumb off, it comes off on your thumb. So when they say they're water soluble, they really are water soluble. I don't use that at all. Now, we have a set of water soluble pens here this weekend, so when Bruce was writing figures on some of his overheads, he was taking show of hands and he'd write down how many. Well, he doesn't want those figures to stay on there, so he just gets a damp cloth and wipes those off. I always use permanent pens on these, but I find if I do make a mistake, and I haven't used the overhead, get some metho and clean it right off with metho and reuse it straight away. But once it's been on the heat, it will come off with metho, but it's very obvious it's a second-hand transparency. But I can clean up a whole sheet, and I have done that, because I'm being a perfectionist. If I get a wrong word, I'll say, oh, that'll do, and no, I can't stand it. So I'll clear the whole sheet or half the sheet and start again. No worries. But once it's been on the heat, it's a little bit harder to get off. It will come off, but sometimes you'll get a bit of the surface of the slide off. These are relatively expensive. I don't know how much they'd be to buy at the newsagent. Brad gets them from uni for me. And I think I pay $50 a box for 100. They're about 50 cents each. They're not cheap. So every time you speak, you can go through a few dollars. Or prepare a lecture, you go through a few dollars, and the pens are dear too. But these ones, the ones that you photograph on, are about 70 cents each. So you need to think carefully about those. And we use so many at Emmaus that Emmaus does offer to reimburse, because for people who are full-time workers, that's quite a big expense. And each year we get a form from Emmaus saying, give us how much you've spent on overheads. Well, that's good of Emmaus to think like that. Then there's a little bit about making transparencies on a copier, which is the sort of thing you do with this one, or with this one. You need, see how that one, the ones that you make on the copier usually have a corner missing. See how the corner's missing on that?
and that's for you to distinguish which, whether that's a heat transparency or an ordinary one. If you get your transparencies mixed up before they're copied or used, if you get them confused, you can usually tell the heat ones have got a corner missing. That one's wrecked up the system. You can tell that's a heat one because you can see where the backing's been stuck onto it. Now, another good thing, I don't know whether Cedric's been using his frames this summer. I saw him with frames in his hand the other day. Sometimes these fit into a cardboard frame, and it's good because if you don't want many notes, you can write your notes on the cardboard frame. You're the only one that can see them. So you can have whatever you want. You can have your points written on your transparency, and your notes can be attached to the cardboard frame, and nobody can see those. We have a frame on one of ours at our projectors at Parramatta, and it's a plastic frame, and it's really great for superimposing. If you're doing a children's story or if you're building something up, you drop your transparency on your overhead and it slides exactly into a frame. Then you can put another one and you just drop the next one on top. Now, if I didn't have a frame there, it would take me a couple of minutes to get that exactly lined up. And look, it's still not lined up properly. And there'd be a whole lot of fiddling around trying to get them exactly on top of each other. Whereas if it goes in the frame, you can just build and build and build. You just drop them on and they automatically are held in the same position. And you can superimpose. Very, very efficient. We've talked about adding colour. Any other questions about the use of the overhead?
What are the rolls that you can get to go in and roll across the screen?
I've never used them. I've seen them, but I've never used them. I don't know why I've never used them.
Would you particularly turn them off if you were just with everything that way?
The only time you turn those off is when you want the class to look to you rather than to there. I should imagine that would be use when you were teaching, say, in a school, and you wanted to use that instead of a blackboard and you just wind it on. That's where I would see that off the top of my head. If you're using it over and over, yes, if you're using the same sequence over and over again, but quite often you don't use exactly the same sequence over and over again. Yes, I should imagine we're more in a teaching situation than the sort of situation we're doing. This is a teaching situation, but a whole different situation. Very well.
Do you have songs on that here, or are they bundled?
Well, we're using both at the moment. We have all the scripture in song overhead, because our song leaders like people to get their heads out of their books. But we also realise that we have some older people in our assembly who still like to sing out of redemption. And we try to cater for the older folk rather than just say, okay, we've wiped redemption and we're having all scripture in song. We use the overheads and the redemption songs. We don't have redemption songs on overhead.